And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. This is now the 12th night, and there are 5 interviews tonight. In an hour from now, it'll be Stefan Korte, then Paul Weston, then Prosopa Insights, and then finally The Distributist. But first, I'm here with the Jolly Heretic. Now, I should say, I've only just woken up about half an hour ago, so if I sound a bit groggy, that's why. It's necessary to become nocturnal during Millennial, because otherwise you just couldn't do it. All right. Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, welcome back to Millennial. I think you've been on most years for the last... quite a long time. I can't remember exactly.
It's 2019, except 1 year where I assume I was boring the previous year, so you didn't have me on. But then I was on. I think most years. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So well, welcome back, and thank you for
welcome
doing
back.
This.
Cheers. Merry Christmas.
Cheers. Yeah, I should say this is just a 1 hour stream because we've scheduling nonsense. So that's why. And so if you do have questions for Ed, now would be the time to post them, super chats. But in the meantime, Ed, you wanted to talk about senility, and it's a horrible topic because I've had 3 relatives who had dementia. It's a terrible condition, and you've got a relative just now with it. Do we know yet what actually causes dementia?
This is the problem. We're not 100% sure, and so as a consequence, there's unless it's caught very early, there's very little that can be done about it. And so it's an appalling thing. I one of the things that got me thinking about it is that I had a book out this year called it was called Genius Under House Arrest: The Cancellation of James Watson. And one of the things that I take the view that the year 2007, when he was cancelled, was an inflection point. It was a turning point. It was like this is kind of the only living genius. This is one of the consequences of his discovery of the structure of DNA. All of the you know, targeted medicines, including against things like Alzheimer's, DNA databases and all of this kind of stuff is incredible. As is the human genome. You know, which he was responsible for starting off the human genome for. It's amazing, and he had this reputation for being outspoken, which makes sense, because if you're like the genius type, as I may have discussed on here other years, the genius type is highly intelligent, but he's also moderately antisocial. And this means that he dares to question taboos. He likes questioning taboos. He has the low impulse control, which allows you to think outside the box. You know, that's he has the kind of mental instability, which makes him think all the time and generate new ideas. And so these kinds of people will tend to, there's a known phenomenon where geniuses tend to enter, who, let's say, the guy that invented the transistor radio, Shockley or whatever, then enter into forbidden areas. And when they cancelled him in 07 because of his remarks on race, he just said his honest view, which was that all of the studies on the future of Africa assume that we will that it's just like us, but all of the studies tell us, well, not really, because of genetic differences in intelligence. One of the things they kept saying was, "Oh well, he's an old man. He's an old man, and so he's an old man, and that's that. That's the problem, right?" The implication was that because he's old, and he wasn't even that old at the time that it happened. He was he a bit over? Was he? I think he was under 80. I think he might have been 79 in 07. then he can be dismissed. He's a silly old man. And equally, I had this when I got in touch with the people that were in charge of the laboratory that he worked at. That, you know, he's an old man, and he wasn't an elderly man and not in the best of health. So I thought that was interesting, because the implication was we're explaining away what he said as not true because he's an elderly man, but also, but we're still going to punish him. We're still going to strip him of his titles. We're still going to have him resign as head of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. We're still going to punish him because what he's done, his heresy, is so appalling. But the assumption was that it was just so bad. But in answer to your question, I mean, it's a progressive damage to the brain cells. So there's not really a single cause. You have different kinds of dementia. The main one is Alzheimer's. This is 80% of cases. And so this is the one that's in many ways the best one to have, because you can still have a conversation with a person that has Alzheimer's. You can talk to them, you can chat away to them and whatever. And it might take a while, and then they'll make one funny remark like, so who are you again? And that's then you know, oh, hang on a minute. No, this is Alzheimer's. So in some ways that's the most poignant, because they're still, they change. A lot of things change about them. I mean, for example, the sex drive changes and can actually get like higher, which can lead to peculiar things. And the impulse control falls away. So they'll behave in all kinds of ways they wouldn't. Basically, the brain is rotting. So the neurons are breaking up, and they're not creating new memories. And so they become childlike, and they feel feelings, but they don't know why, because they just don't understand why they're feeling them. And this can lead to them being sort of explosive and confused and all kinds of things like that. But you can at least chat with them. There's other ones which are like Joe Biden. I don't know exactly what type he had, but it's with vascular dementia, which is the second most common. Blood flow is restricted to the brain. And there's frontal temporal dementia as well, which is abnormal sort of, that leads to personality behavior changes. And then it's much more difficult to have a conversation. So with Joe Biden, you notice that he's sort of mumbling and not able to string words together and that kind of thing. Alzheimer's isn't like that. Alzheimer's, they just become increasingly forgetful. With these kinds, with him, you can't really have a conversation with a person like that. And some of them with prefrontal dementia, they can become absolutely paranoid and weird. They'll have visions and things like that. I know of a case, a book I wrote years ago on the guy that came up with culture shock, the idea of culture shock, this model of culture shock, Glover Oberg, and his mother had prefrontal dementia, and she would see ghosts, have visions that her dead son was alive, all kinds of things. So in terms of the causes that they know of, those are the main the main causes are developments of that, of those specific problems, builds up abnormal buildup of proteins. That's what causes Alzheimer's, some sort of genetic problem, so that these proteins build up and it leads therefore to cell death and brain shrinkage. Or in vascular dementia, it's narrowed blood vessels, and so you less blood is getting to the brain. With some of them, it's just the degeneration of the frontal lobes for some reason, and then some of them are mixed. And then less likely, traumatic brain injury. So you may be aware that there's a problem with footballers who were footballers in like the 50s or the 60s, where they used a very hard ball, and that can do it. Boxers, that sort of thing. Infections can do it. Brain tumors, certain kinds can do it. Metabolic issues, so problems with blood sugar, that can do it. And long-term substance abuse. But it seems to be, it's partly heritable, doubles every year, the risk from the age of 65. But it's partly heritable, probably about 0.5, I think. So, yeah, it's and they in the end, Jim, I think, did have dementia. Jim Watson, but not till right at the end. So I met him in 2023, and then he was sharp. And you saw when we started talking about his breakthrough, there was this glint in his eye, that you could tell you were dealing, you know, that they say, you know, there's not much behind the eyes. And with someone that's highly intelligent, there is a lot behind the eyes. And he glinted, and he was talking about all kinds of interesting based things. He was saying, like, best not repeat. Apparently by the end, he for example, he'd forgotten who I was. Although he only met me once, but he was 96 or whatever he was.
And he lived, so that's like the last 2 years of his life, maybe even less, that he had dementia.
Yeah, so in 2019, he had a car crash. And then just before the car, was it before the car crash? I can't remember, but in the same year, he'd repeated, he was asked, there was this, they did this documentary kind of called American Masters, where they were, the aim was to kind of defend him. But the host asked the same question: have you changed your mind what you said in 07? He said, no, it's the truth. And then they completely defenestrated him. So having made him resign as head of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, they then had him, they took away his honorary professorships, honorary emeritus chancellor, renamed buildings that were named after him. They were completely, you know, humiliated. And the terrible thing was that this guy was a man of the left, or at least he thought he was. His parents were Democrats. His father was an atheist, and which was very rare in America at that time. And he couldn't believe it. And apparently he actually said when this all broke in 07, and you've got the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, saying what an awful man he is. And he was in England when it broke. He was in England to promote his book, Avoid Boring People. When it all broke, then he said to his friend, like, what would my parents think? What would my parents think if they were alive, that I'm being called a racist? He was so ashamed of this. But that's what he was like throughout his life. And so there possibly is, I don't know, I'm speculating here, but to bring it back to,
Just to clarify, James Watson worried that his parents would be ashamed of him.
If they were alive, yeah. He was like, right. What would my parents say? What would my parents say? But to bring it back to, I don't know whether it's early onset Alzheimer's or the drink, but I don't remember this conversation in a pub in London where we agreed we'd talk about this, but I'm happy to go with it. As long as I can bring it back to James Watson. The symptoms will start to manifest quite a long time before it becomes a serious problem. So although, you know, I like to be dismissive of the, I don't like this idea of them saying in 2007 or 2019, oh, yeah, he's an old man, you know, old people say silly things, bless them. I think he's either right or he isn't. And one of the things I showed in the book with regard to every controversial thing he said was that he was generally correct. He was empirically correct. But there is some truth in it, in that, as I understand it, the symptoms will be subtly noticeable for as much as a decade before it starts to become a serious problem. But particularly with Alzheimer's, in very, very subtle ways. So very, very subtly, you're being a bit more forgetful, and your impulse control is very subtly decreasing. So it is conceivable that early signs of the dementia in a very subtle way played a role in him just going for it and saying something that was just almost like truth Tourette's, you know, that he must have known. Although, to be fair, he thought he was having a private conversation. He was playing tennis with this girl called Charlotte Hunt Grubb, who was a person who he'd mentored as a female scientist and who had lived in his house. And she worked for the Sunday Times. And she reported back what he'd said. I think there was some kind of confusion. Like, I don't know if Jim realised that what he said would be reported. Perhaps he did. And if he did, then that shows a lack of thinking. That shows an impulsiveness of a very extreme kind. Although if you go back throughout his life, the bluntness and the is incredible. So in when he got the Nobel Prize and whatever, he published this book on how this all happened, the double helix, and he sent it out to people who he had described or whatever, who he'd written about in the book, including Francis Crick, for them to read it. And they threatened to sue. Like, he wrote things that were so egregious. He repeated confidences. He, you know, betrayed confidences. The people threatened to sue him unless he removed from the book things that they regarded as unpleasant or as unacceptable about themselves. So that was the kind of guy he was.
Well, that would seem like a symptom of autism, where he didn't realize the secondary or tertiary effects of something that he's going to do. Social effect.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think there's evidence that he probably did have... it's important not to... It's been going on for years.
Asperger's.
Yeah, everybody has everybody has autism. I have autism. You have autism. All your viewers have autism. But he may have been... I think I did write in the book that he was elevated in a lot of the trait. All kinds of things, like that he dressed in the most bizarre way. You know, when I met him, it was this guy of, I think he was 95 at the time, coming downstairs in shorts and a t-shirt. It just looked weird. And then he even when he was young, he dressed in this extraordinary manner. He writes about how he didn't know how to talk to people. He didn't know how to deal with people. He seemed to have an anxious attachment style. And he writes about this. In fact, he actually wrote a book. He was obsessive, clearly. He absolutely was obsessed with bird watching. And he writes in his memoirs in turgid detail that no one cares about bird watching. He was obviously extremely sensitive to all kinds of sensations. He would offend people, so he had problems with social skill, as you pointed out. Was very, very focused on sort of systematizing and making sense of things to the neglect of other things. He liked learning lots of information off by heart. He didn't have narrow interests, though. That was the thing that was different. So autistic people are stereotyped to have narrow interests. That's all they like. No, he had very broad interests. And this was why he was able to make the breakthrough that he made. He wasn't trained in chemistry. He was trained in zoology. And then he went into some completely different subject. And that's where he made his connection. And that's what often happens with geniuses. They are trained in one subject, but they are so intellectually voracious and they're so high in openness that they read around all kinds of other things, almost like ADHD. Oh, I'll go to this, I'll go to this, I'll go to this, I'll go to this. And then they make connections that others don't make. But in a lot of ways, he was probably quite high in autism. And another obsession, interestingly, was girls. So he wrote a whole book called Genes, Girls and Gamow about all the different girls that he had humped and would like to hump, which is you know, an unusual thing for the Nobel Prize winner for science, for chemistry, to write. But that's what he did. And he obviously had this anxious attachment style. And autistics often have that. They have an anxious attachment style. He writes about a relationship with a woman called Krista Mayo. I have to be careful what I say about her. She's still alive. But it's very clear he's constantly anxious. Does she love me? Does she not? It's an anxious attachment style, which a lot of autists seem to have, because they experience the world as this swirling chaos they can't make sense of, because they don't know the social rules and they get constantly, you know, told off and told they've done something bad and so on. So yeah, but so the if you want to return it to dementia, it may have played a role. Yeah, I didn't really think of it till now, to be honest. I didn't even put this in the book. But it may have been an early onset, an earlier thing, because it's such a taboo, and it seemed and he was in a position where you just think to yourself, surely he would know, in the context of 07, and in particular in the context of 2019, just how outraged that what this would do. I mean, I started on YouTube in 2019, and I met you in 2019, didn't I? In April 2019. And if we think about it, I do feel that it's less oppressive now than it was. It's like it got to peak oppression.
And, well, I would say all of that peaked in, that like the wokery in general peaked in 2020, 21. That's my clear feeling about it. But throughout the 2010s, and the 2000s, but again, you see, what they could have meant when they said he's an old man is he's just not familiar with the modern taboos. He doesn't know what is sayable nowadays and what it's not sayable nowadays. They might not have meant that he's, you know, senile. It's a well-known thing that old people are just not hip to modern trends and fashions. So they'll say something like, you know, I can remember my my grandmother. She used the word darkies, but she wasn't, you know, she wasn't political about it. It was just what she said, because that's what people used to say in the 60s and 50s and 40s. So now and again,
I should emphasize that. Well, you may be right if it was that if it was that term used independently, that they would say he's elderly and not well. They would also imply he was ill. Which I can only assume is mentally ill, because we know he wasn't physically ill, because he was driving a car about in his 90s. So I think that was what they were doing. I mean, it was the pressure that they must have been under as a public institution, and that's the as well that he's like the. I don't know if we would say Tim Berners-Lee is a genius. Maybe he is. But I think most people would acknowledge that Jim Watson was one of few people that was alive that was a genius. And then since his death, they've been playing it down as well. They've been playing down his contribution. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is that it's Jim Watson and he's this evil racist, and so they want to play down his contribution. And the second is, I think, that they want to just... It's almost like, frankly... There was a book, I forget what it was called, it was by some woman, obviously, because you don't really get women geniuses, that was condemning the very idea of genius and saying, no, there's no such thing as genius. Oh, no, it's a patriarchal construct, which is insane, because genius is a quality. We know what we mean by it. It's a person that makes some massive, enormous, important contribution, and the experts in the field agree is massive and important. And if you
you'll agree with this, the very idea of genius is... It's something that women are averse to because they don't like the idea of someone breaking the mold and breaking the rules and doing what you're not supposed to do, and taking something in an unexpected direction. You know, individual women might find that sexually attractive in a guy, but most women, I think, when it comes to any sort of social arena, they despise the rule breakers and the oddballs.
This is true. There was a fascinating study out of Sweden recently, which I did a video about, which showed that if you're a far left woman, then you will get a more sympathetic hearing for your views from far right men than from left wing women. Because even though you're on their side, you're on the side of the left-wing women, because that is how intolerant they are of dissent, yes, due to the evolution to not want conflict, because they can't deal with conflict because they're physically weak and they have babies to protect, due to the evolution towards these equalitarian friendships of alloparents of their kids, due to higher social anxiety and neuroticism with regard to things holding together and whatever, and not being able to defend themselves. So this is true. So one of the things that's happening is they're trying to, since his death, is they're trying to make out that this was some group thing. This was a bunch of people working together, which is true in so much as there was a research group composed of Francis Crick, Jim Watson, whatever the guy was called from New Zealand, Maurice Wilkins, and this Rosalind Franklin, who died in the 50s of age 38 of cancer, that there was a number of people involved. Interestingly, Rosalind had her student, whose name I can't remember, take a photograph of this, you know, an X-ray of DNA. And she didn't notice. She had the information in front of her eyes. I mean, she had this photograph. But she didn't understand its importance. She didn't make the connection, even though she had the photograph and she had her student take it. It was Watson that was shown the photograph by somebody at King's College London and suddenly realised. And then it was Francis Crick that went into the Eagle Pub in Cambridge and said, "Gentlemen, we have discovered the secret of life." But there's no we about this. And this is what Watson said to me when I met him. He said it was my idea. And he says this in his memoirs as well. He talks about that it sent him almost like a eureka moment. It sent him into almost a religious experience where he was lying on his bed, looking at images of DNA floating around above his head. It was this incredible, overwhelming, almost religious experience, which is consistent with a certain psychology of these people. If they're high in openness is associated with having weird psychological experiences and things like that. And the openness also makes them open to new ideas, open to interesting possibilities, open to investigating things, open to reading around the subject, and all this kind of thing. So it was a group thing in a sense, but in a sense it wasn't. In a sense, it was Jim. And there've been various news articles since that have argued that, oh, yeah, he was part of Francis Crick's research team. No. He made the discovery. We're uncomfortable with it. We're moving against it, but we're still in this situation where we don't like quite... It's elitist. The concept of genius is elitist. It implies that some people are basically more useful to society than others. Some people are great. Some people are amazing. And as we said about women, girls' groups in particular are rather uncomfortable with that idea. And if you're a girl and you stand out and you're the queen bee, then you know, you'll get the whispering and the knowing look, and you'll find yourself excluded.
I mean, a similar thing happens in male circles as well. With women, it's she's prettier than the rest of us. Let's bring her down. But with men, it's he's smarter than the rest of us. Let's make sure he doesn't succeed. I mean, I've been victim to that, frankly. I'll just be out very overt about it. It's happened to me. It's happened to a lot of guys. The crabs in the bucket mentality is there among men as well.
That's an interesting point.
Go on.
No, that's an interesting point. Let's talk about that. That's a good point. It is there, but I think it's less extreme because men are...
Oh, I agree.
Well, it's just two things. It's less extreme because men are evolved to be part of an army. So what we want is talent. And yes, we're competing against each other. We are competing ultimately for girls or money or whatever. Ultimately for girls in evolution. But we make alliances, and we make large. They make small alliances because they're women, because their system is you get a small number of allo parents, and because they're going to look after your children, for Christ's sake, you have to absolutely trust them. The only way you can trust them is to share lots of information with them, bond with them, share your traumas and whatever with them. And that militates in favor of a small number of people. Well, men aren't doing any gay stuff like that, are they? Men are forming much broader coalitions with much weaker boundaries, and they're based in part around what do you bring to this army, what talent do you have. Now, if your ambition and your self self belief exceeds your talent, then I think that's a problem with men. If you're a bullshitter, basically, if you make out that you're all talented and great and useful, and when it comes to it, you're no good. You're basically a parasite, if that's the case. And I think that's the thing that men are concerned about, parasites, other men that are parasites off the group. And if you're openly ambitious, if you're too openly ambitious, then they'll go for you because we're all competing against each other. And so if you're openly ambitious, that's like putting a mark on your head saying, well, I'm going to get ahead of you.
Well, the thing is, when men get jealous of one guy, another guy can point out, well, hold on, his abilities will help us as a group. When women get jealous of a woman for being more beautiful than the rest of them, no one can point out the same thing. No one can say, well, hold on, her looks will help the rest of us. Because they won't.
I suppose they could do. I don't know. I'm not being a woman, but I suppose they could do in the sense that she will attract fit guys. And they might get some of the cast-offs.
Well,
But no, probably not. No. As I understand it, with female friendship groups, they're quite similar in terms of how good-looking they are. That's yes. Probably true with male friendship groups as well. But I'm told it's particularly similar with female friendship groups, and they are more likely to attack So there was, I don't know if you know a woman called Danny, God, I can't remember her surname, but an Australian academic, Danny Korsowski, her name is. And she did a really interesting paper where she showed that women will persuade other women that they should have short hair. Which is inherently,
yes.
Now,
yes.
I remember when I was at school, right, my mum went and got her hair cut short. And she came out, I was about 14. And she came out the hairdressers, me and my dad were there, and we were both like, what the bloody hell? You know, she looked like a pixie. And we were just saying, what have you done? And she was saying, oh, all my friends, because she's a teacher, all my friends at school are saying my hair looks great. I'm like, of course they are.
Sabotaging your chances.
Right. That's exactly what a woman is doing when she cuts her hair short. And the women that will persuade her to cut it short or will tell her it looks good short will be those that are her level of attractiveness. Because they are competitors with her for men of that level of attractiveness. They're not competitors with really good looking women. They're not competing with them. That's a different class of woman that will then be associated with a different class of man. If they see them as about their level of good lookingness, they're a competitor, and then they will persuade them to cut their hair short, which is inherently always, always makes women look less attractive. And so that's one of the sabotage tactics that they employ. It's quite interesting. Yeah,
just on the matter of women and greatness and equality and so on, I was reminded of that the other day when I saw this photo. This is appalling. Ofcom is taking people from big tech to enforce the new internet regulations, and it just happens to be six fucking women.
Oh,
I mean, how awful is that? Six nurse ratchets in one room just waiting to find ways to censor men who are saying things that we shouldn't be saying, apparently.
It's horrific.
I mean, it's horrific. That's the word. Dreadful.
I assume those women, most of whom have long hair, have persuaded the one on the end to cut her hair short.
But, maybe.
No, it's a terrible idea because they are much more censorious, and so they are inherently more censorious. They're higher in social anxiety, and there's many studies that they're more socially conformist. They're more concerned with feelings and equality than they are with truth and logic. These things are very important to them. And so unless they are extreme outliers as women, and I don't suspect they are, then they will be very, very censorious. And it is them, as I said with that study from Sweden, the study found that left-wing men are less tolerant than right-wing men, but the difference is quite small. And right-wing women are less tolerant. Are more tolerant than left-wing women, but they are less tolerant than right-wing men. So the big driver of woke and the utter intolerance is sex, is gender. Yeah. And so they will censor it. It's a terrible idea.
Absolutely awful. I mean, they are going to ruin the internet in Britain. If you wanted to ruin the internet in Britain, you'd assemble a team like this.
Yes,
six fucking dull women.
The lanyard class. I mean, what the over promotion of women does as well is very interesting. I mean, that's been if we're rounding up the year, then you have these fires in Los Angeles. What was that? Women being promoted not because they're the best, but because they're women. You have it's going back to the previous year, but the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. Woman not covering him, you know, not doing what she should be doing. Too short. And most recently, you have them appointing the first female Archbishop of Canterbury, despite the fact that, unlike most archbishops, she doesn't have a doctorate. You know, she's not particularly intellectual. And they're looking into stopping her being enthroned. Because when she was Bishop of London, which was also an over promotion, there was this scandalous report in with all kinds of gossip and tittle-tattle about various people, and she didn't. It's clear that she didn't read it. There's evidence she didn't read it, even though she should have read it. And as a consequence of this, one particular vicar who was accused of various things killed himself. And they're seriously looking into stopping the enthronement. This is the Lanyard Archbishop of Canterbury, and it already appears to be a problem.
Yeah, that's a phrase that I've seen used by Douglas Carswell and I think David Starkey this year. I get the reference. Let's get it back to Francis, James Watson and senility. Do you think that he was? It almost seems strange to me that after he died, this has continued. I would have thought not out of guilt, just but out of the changing climate, the speech climate. I would have thought this would become more seeable now than it was in 2007 or even 2019. But it seems that they're maintaining this. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if, with the decline of trans to some extent, the race stuff is going to become front and center again in the equality drive. There was a statement today from J.D. Vance to that. You know, the idea that they're going to go for race blindness, basically. And it seems that with trans as an extreme experiment out now kind of going out of fashion, they're going to the focus is going to be back on race, making that something that simply doesn't matter. And in that climate, yeah, James Watson's statement is...
If race doesn't matter, then you have color. You'll be colorblind. I mean, like look at what's happened at the Ivy League universities, where they were sued for their racial discrimination policies against white people and against East Asian people, and they were forced to end this positive discrimination in favor of blacks. So, if we move to a situation where race doesn't matter, which I think we should. In the sense of appointments, then fine.
But what I meant by race doesn't matter is there's no reality to it. Egalitarianism. Like you've got to assume that all the races are the same. I think that seems to be what they're moving back to, and then meritocracy operates on top of that.
I don't think they moved away from that.
No, I don't think so either. I'm just saying that in recent years, there's been a focus on things like trans and gay feminism. I'm just wondering, is this going to be the ultimate thing that they're not going to let go of? Like we have to be race.
I think that they've. That's an interesting question. I suppose you could argue. I think that we've discussed before, that what we're seeing is a natural backlash for a number of reasons. Mainly that Generation Z are the first generation that have been brought up with this insanity. And so there's a natural rebellion among a portion of them to what they've been brought up with. Add to that the fact that it's a very bad situation for them economically. It's not like when we left university and you could just go and get a job. And only like a third of people had degrees, so it's now they're angry, they're unhappy, and they're at that age where you rebel, and so you rebel against what you've been brought up with. Among a portion of them, some of them will super conform, of course, and that is woke, and that's why it gets to a point where someone like Lick Fuentes can say Hitler was cool. Because that's the ultimate way to rebel against this generation that's brought them up, and also because they haven't been brought up like we were with the direct, with granddad talking about what he did in North Africa all the bloody time. There's no connection for them. It's like it would be as if we had been brought up being told these bad things are happening to you because of stuff that happened in 1910. You'd be like, fuck off. So that the various if that shift is happening, then that would militate in favor of other rebellions, including potentially in relation to race. Now, what could be argued, which is an interesting point, is that when you know you're losing power, when you know you're losing it, there's a period where they clamp down. I think you saw this in the 50s. The 50s was more right-wing than the 40s. There was the last hurrah of conservatism. You know, homosexuality being prosecuted in England, for example. Earlier in the 30s, people would just overlook it. But in the 50s, they were David Maxwell Fife was seriously prosecuting this. You have people like Lord Bewley and whatever. And it was very unpopular that he was doing this. It didn't have now people thought that just, you know, they're queers, but leave them alone. I think the last hurrah was what we've seen in the last 5 years or so. That was them really clamping, or the last 10 years. That was them really clamping down in response to Trump, in response to whatever. Whereas now, my suspicion is that it will gradually just loosen up. They will gradually there is a backlash happening against them, and it will become fashionable. It's increasingly so, as evidenced by the fact that the more I go to these conferences, the more I see women there, young women, and women are performing.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the quote from J.D. Vance that I was talking about. So this is what I think is going to be the recourse, at least for the centre right wing. I think it's going to be a sort of 80s race blindness, where your race is just not supposed to matter to anyone. The fact that you've got black skin or the color of your skin is just not supposed to matter to you. You're definitely not supposed to identify with it or whatever. And that is the way to stymie white racial consciousness in America and probably here as well. That's what I suspect.
That's interesting. That's a very interesting point, Rose. Isn't another way of interpreting that is that what we were seeing was a right wing backlash. Just as if you think about the left wing backlash, or whatever you want to call it, of the 60s onwards, or the left wing backlash from the 90s onwards, then it's not immediately overwhelming. It goes through stages. So it starts off if we think about the wokeness or whatever, it starts off in the 90s by the Stephen Lawrence inquiring, going on about race. And then it moves from that to gays, and then it moves from that to transsexuals. So if there was a right-wing backlash, couldn't you argue that it would move through this phase? So there'll be the race-blind 80s phase, and then eventually we'll go back to the 70s and the 60s.
Well, let's hope so.
That would be logical, because once it starts, just as we've had decades since the 60s, really, of competitive virtue signalling, where we've moved from race and sex to homosexuality to transsexuality to, you know, even maps, you know, basically being pro-paedophilia. I mean, that's how far it got about 5 years.
What was that? What was that word? Maps?
Minor attracted persons.
I remember that.
They don't like being called paedophiles. It's offensive. So then wouldn't it?
It's got connotations logical? Attached to it, you know. Sorry, go on.
It's got negative connotations. Yeah, it's got negative connotations. Thomas Hamilton and Sidney Cook and whatever. It's got these negative connotations. They want their maps. The maps
it's
and the
like,
crowd.
It's like how half-caste went to mixed race. I get it. Yeah, so I'll stop interrupting you.
A mixed heritage, and yeah, sure. So what you would expect to happen would be a kind of competitive, the other way round, would be a competitive basedness signalling. In the same way that in Victorian England, you had a competitive purity signalling, such that at the beginning of her reign, illegitimacy was not that bad. It was not that bad. And the King William IV, who preceded Victoria, had various illegitimate daughters by mistresses that hung around the court and were ladies in waiting and whatever. It wasn't that bad. And as the Victorian era continued, you have this continual purity signalling, probably set off by all of these illnesses becoming endemic at the same time. And eventually it's the most terrible, awful thing. So I suggest that could happen again. You'll get competitive purity signalling until there is a degree to which the attitudes of the 70s or 60s kind of come back. I can see it in relation to religion already. I mean, even in if you think about what they're like on the you know, the right. You know, I don't know if you know Evelyn, this far right homosexual transsexual.
Yes.
Right. Now, I had her on. The first time I had her on, it was fine. The second time, I had a much bigger channel, and there was absolute outrage.
I had her on with Scrump on Millennial a few years ago, and there was a terrible backlash. And I think it's worth saying that in the case of Evelyn, that there is actually it's not like she just chose to do this. There is a hormonal, he was born with a serious hormonal problem, and his way of dealing with it is this. It's not something that he just, you know, chose for the sake of it.
As I said explicitly, yeah. Homosexual transsexual, which is the minority, i.e. highly feminized, almost intersexual males. So this is not one of these people with. Yes, this is not one of these people with a personality disorder that narcissistically is aroused by the idea of themselves as a woman. Those people are mainly once they transition, are mainly lesbians. There was this huge backlash. So that's where it'll go to. So it'll go to potentially with the competitive purity signaling. It will go to a situation where. You know, if you know that poem by Philip Larkin, High Windows, and he says, in fact, I've got it over here. He says, it's written probably in the mid-60s, and it says, you know, when I see a couple, and I guess that she's page 17. Yes, it says it says. Sorry about this. It says, when I see a couple of kids and guess he's fucking her and she's taking pills or wearing a diaphragm, I know this is paradise. Everyone old has dreamed of all their lives, bonds and gestures pushed one side like an outdated combine harvester, and everyone young going down the long slide. And he says, if someone had told me 40 years back, I'd have thought that'd be the life. No God anymore and hell, no worrying about hell and that and what you think of the priest. All his lot were gone down the long slide like three bloody birds. But then he becomes nostalgic. Rather than words comes the thought of high windows, the sun comprehending glass, and beyond it the deep blue air that shows nothing as new as endless. So he's nostalgic for the old time. And I can imagine this reversing. I can imagine there being a future poet, a future Larkin, who thinks to himself, oh, I know this is paradise. Look at this couple over there, and they've got a chaperone, and they're based, and they're Christian, and they're white, and they're wholesome, and they're all these things. If someone had told me back in 2020, it'd be like this. God, I wouldn't have believed them. All the young going down the long side, not in the dark, scared of the woke mob. You know, isn't it great? But you can see how there might be some nostalgia for a period of, you know, sort of sexual freedom or whatever that would go, because they'll just be new taboos.
Yeah, and the grass is always greener. You're always thinking about, well, some of us are always thinking about, what if? What wouldn't that be nice? And wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that be novel? Because it would be different from the mores of one's time. But I take the point. We should get to the super chats and see if anyone does have questions for you. Okay, yes, there are a few. Starshine said to me, thank you for these interesting interviews and introductions to lesser-known podcasters as well as fan favourites. please consider interviewing Kate Fanning next year on Millennial. Best wishes and thank you. Well, she was on a few years ago. She has appeared. I think she was calling herself Baba Kate at that time, and that's what to look for on the website, and you'll find that interview. Okay, Pleb Lordy asks, what is Michael Woodley up to nowadays? Any chance of a reunion? I used to enjoy your discussions back in the day. I used to ask questions as Frank Slater. Michael Woodley.
Yes, I get the distinct impression that no, Michael. I mean, his website is down at the moment, so I don't know what he's doing. But he seems to have reinvented himself as a person that researches the intelligence of birds, and he's just sort of just dropped out of it, really. So I don't think there's any likelihood of him coming back on. No.
Right. Okay. McGee Willis, what do you guys think of the recent Christian revival on the right wing? Is it real? It seems like Christianity has endured much longer in the European consciousness than many thought it would. I'll say something quickly. I think that anything, when people take to something, it's not real for them at first. It's an affectation. It's a novelty. It's a bit of an act almost. But then it becomes real over time. And then also there are others for whom it's real from the very beginning, and they're the ones who drive it, and so on. So it's a mix. When you say that it's something new, real, I think it's always going to be a mix. But anyway, Ed, what would you say about the Christian revival on the...
My understanding from the data, from UK data, is that there is a slight revival driven by young men. And so it is men as opposed to women that are more likely to be rebellious, and young men in particular. And so in a woke context, if you're being told, you know, be woke and whatever, then one form of rebellion is to be Christian. And the study that I read indicated in particular it was kind of a traditional form of Christianity, you know, trad Catholicism, things like that. So like a complete rejection of the modern world. And I think Woz is right that then there's a certain psychology that's associated with that, often slight mental instability. And so you look for something very black and white and clear, and you change identity when you're unhappy, you get a strong new identity. And that seems to be that. But I'm not surprised that there would be some kind of revival, because if there is a right-wing backlash, which there seems to be some evidence of, then that would be a way of expressing that would be a manifestation of that, and it would be more likely to be men than women, because men are more rebellious, and that's what is my reading seems to be going on.
All right, and and then women will take to it, and especially once they see it as a road to stability, security, because I think there is a lot of insecurity and instability now, and I think that's going to increase in the next few years with economic turmoil. So I think people are going to be looking for safe havens, and
but at the same time, a certain kind of woman will think to herself, "I'll get in there early to get the best return." And those are the kinds of women that are probably going to be involved in it now. I suggest those are probably outliers in terms of females. Those are probably women that are high in dark triad traits, and they will get in there early, as it were, to get the best return. And then the more conformist ones will come along later. I mean, you saw this in Finland in my own lifetime. I've been in this country for 20 years. The country has shifted while I've been here. From being a country that was just, you know, openly and proudly ethnocentric, racist, and that's what everybody was, to being now woke, and probably more woke than Britain, because there's not a debate happening here about ending woke, really. It's much more limited, because they're so socially conformist, and so it just spreads through the population, and it will spread the other way through the population. I personally find it amazing. My inclination is always to think, if there's some sort of fad, well, what the hell's going on here? And just naturally to do the opposite, just to be contrarian, whatever nonsense is happening at any given time. But that's not. I'm afraid that's not the case with most people. When Princess Diana died, I remember thinking to myself, well, there were two things that annoyed me as a kid that were on TV all the time, Northern Ireland and Princess Diana.
I remember that moment, yeah.
And in 1997, 8, they both stopped being on TV. And I was happy. And
that would be later than that, because Diana died in 97. So there'd be about a year or so when it was just all over the place.
But 99, Northern Ireland and Princess Diana was over, and there could actually be relevant things on the news.
And then it was the millennium, and you were hearing about the Millennium Dome and so on.
Yeah, and the Millennium Bug.
Yeah, yeah, the Y2K. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and you know, I'll say this again. When I named my channel, it was a reference to the generation, the millennials, but it was also a reference to that. Because I thought it was a reference to that era, the millennial era, because I thought that was extending. I thought we were still in the millennial era, but I didn't realize no one is actually using that word anymore for this era. By 2014, 2013, that had already ended. And I didn't realize. But so it was supposed to be about the woes of the time.
Of the millennium.
So, yeah. And I thought, we're only 13 years into it, for fuck's sake. It's a 1,000-year epoch, so surely it's not too late to use that word. But anyway, doesn't matter now. Okay, and then Angerad said, bless your granny's soul. And she said, geniuses are hot. Love and Yule blessings to you both. I'm always impressed and slightly intimidated by Angerad's passionate nature, heated. I'd love to meet her in real life, but maybe that will happen one day. And she goes on to say, I met Philippe Rushton years ago at an AMREN conference. I was younger, cute, and sweet back then. Rushton answered my silly questions for a long time because I was a cute chick.
Yes, well, he was certainly into the birds, was J. Philippe Rushton. If you read my book on him, J. Philippe Rushton, A Life History Perspective, he has children by assorted women, some of them mistresses. You know, he was certainly a fast life history strategist combined with high intelligence, which seems to be what genius is to some extent.
All right. And then she has said that he completely ignored the worshipful hordes of males awaiting to commune with the master. Ha 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 ha.
He would do because he was into the girls severely.
All right. And then the Thin Red Line said, great stream. Thank you very much. And Herring said, support from Sweden. Thank you very much. And the Wanderer says to you, thank you for your Nick Griffin interview. Merry Christmas and good Yule to you both.
Merry Christmas, sir, and tusen tack to the Swedish person. And thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
All right. I guess that's all the super chats. Is there anything to say in summary about James Watson? I think we've talked about senility and dementia enough. Let's say something to close off about James Watson and his contribution.
The contribution was so enormous. I mean, I go through in the book all of the people that would be dead if he had, or many of them that were famous, that Stephen Fry, Nigella Lawson, there's loads and loads of people that would be dead if you didn't have targeted therapies for cancer. So, for example, just give one example. The effect of that finding was enormous, and it was fine. He was part of a research group, but it was him that noticed it, that made the connections, the synaptic connections that so this is not a group. This is a group, yep, that were helping him out, but he was the one that noticed. And there's certain kinds of amazing people that do that. And what I want to understand is what they're like. And we need to find those people, and we need to nurture those people, and there need to be safe spaces for those people. And the universities are no longer safe spaces for those people because they're chucked out of the universities. And there need to be alternative institutions for those people so that those people can come up with amazing, brilliant ideas and solve problems. And and we're producing fewer of those people, and we're going to have more and more problems that we need to be solved. We only are producing fewer of them because we're getting stupider by one point per decade, one IQ point per decade. But then worse than that, we're under promoting those people. We're promoting, you know, DEI hires over those people. We're excluding those people because they're autistic and say mean things, and this will ultimately lead to our ruin. So we need to get back to highlighting, finding these geniuses, realizing that yes, they're a social irritant, but there's a very good side to them, and finding them safe spaces so they can do their genius work.
Yeah, they actually do need safe spaces. Okay, and then Ranulph said, great stream, Moz. The Jolly Heretic is one of my favourites. On Greg Johnson's stream, you discussed how a lot of people in our spheres are INTJ. That's what I am. We can't take BS, like harming our race. Yeah, absolutely. I think the INTJ is... Ed, I can't remember whether you're into this stuff, the Myers-Briggs classification. But yeah, the INTJ is the engineer kind of archetype. And loads of guys in the alt-right back in the day were INTJ. I think that was the most common. Yes, it was the most common type. It's an interesting type. All right. And then there was one more from the Thin Red Line saying, hello, hello, hello. I think we know where he got that from. All right. So let's end it there. This has been a short stream, but by necessity. So I'm glad that we were able to arrange it, though. And I think it's been interesting. I hope people have got something from it. I'm sure they will have. All right. I'll be back very soon with the next stream. But in the meantime, Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, there was one more. Can you tell Ed I very much enjoyed his Jonathan Bowden biography, regardless of the controversy? It was nice to have a few insights into his life. I heard that you're working on a sequel to that. Is that true?
I thought about it, but no, I think maybe one day I'll do a second edition, because one of the things that happened once I published that book was that then loads of people started getting in touch with me. Oh, I knew him, I can say this. So maybe one day I'll do a second edition. We had an idea of doing a book about his art, but I don't think there's enough for a book. No, but I think I'll probably do a second edition one day.
Yes, good. Get those interviews recorded, because you never know what happens to people. All right. Okay. Let's end it there. Thank you very much, and I'll see you all very soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.